You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Amina Brown. Amina is an author, a spoken word poet, a speaker, and an event host. The author of 5 spoken word albums and 2 nonfiction books, Amina performs and speaks at events from coffeehouses to arenas with a mix of poetry, humor, and storytelling. She and her husband, DJ Opdiggy, reside in Atlanta, Georgia, and the new book is called How to Fix a Broken Record, Thoughts on Vinyl Records, Awkward Relationships, and Learning to Be Myself. Amina, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you grew up in San Antonio, just kind of down the street from me here in Austin. What was your upbringing like?
I grew up a kid of divorced parents who both were in the military at different times. So I grew up experiencing 2 branches of the military in one life. My dad was in the Air Force until he retired. And then my mom later joined the Army as a nurse. So that's actually what sent us to San Antonio. My mom was stationed at Fort Sam Houston. So shout out to any military brats, as they call us, kids of parents in the military. So that was how my upbringing was. I moved around quite a bit because of that. And still, I think, primarily lived in the South, though. Well, in the South and Texas. Texas is its own somebody.
Don't we know it? I mean, San Antonio is a really unique place. I think it's probably a lot larger than most people realize. The culture is really one of its own. Where you went to school and extracurricular stuff, was it a diverse environment?
I'm trying to think, was it a diverse environment? I guess I would say yes. I mean, part of that time I was at the school that was on Fort Sam Houston. So our sort of junior high experience was by its nature going to be diverse because there were all these kids there from all over the country and in some cases from all over the world. So that was a very diverse experience. And then I think I went from that into a private Christian school environment, which was not diverse at all in any way. No.
Because it was white?
Yes. Yes. And it was white, but also at the time, not really comfortable sort of making that an environment where you celebrate other cultures. Like that was like a weird thing. I remember fighting for Black History Month celebrations at school. And that's a part of what made me beg my mom, please let me leave here. Please let me out.
How old were you then when you were at that?
This was 9th and 10th grade. So I just felt like I really wanted to be in a more diverse environment. And I wanted to be in an environment that I felt would celebrate my history and that would be important, you know, to them. So I remember fighting that quite a bit, and I basically almost did the equivalent of doing like a PowerPoint presentation for my mom to please let me go to public school. So she finally was just like, oh, okay, fine, you know. So I spent my last 2 years of high school in a very large public school in San Antonio, and I just have always really thrived in a diverse environment where so many people from so many different cultures are represented there. I mean, before we lived in San Antonio, my mom was stationed in D.C. So we were living there in sort of that D.C., Maryland, Virginia area and going to the Smithsonian and going to Frederick Douglass House. And, you know, so I was sort of coming from a very diverse environment culturally, and I still thrive in that kind of space. So I was really glad my mom agreed to it, because when I went to public school, that's when I discovered spoken word poetry, and I got on the step team in high school, and I started writing poems for my friends and their crushes. I mean, it was fantastic.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about next, is the spoken word and poetry and just writing in general. You said that's where you discovered it at that high school. Did you feel like this is, I think I want this to be a career someday, or did you think about it that far ahead?
No, I didn't know that you could have a career in spoken word at all. That was not, and to be honest, I don't even think I knew it was called spoken word at the time. It was 1996 and the movie Love Jones had just come out, and Lorenz Tate played a spoken word poet in that film. So there are quite a few people who are spoken word poets today because of that movie, particularly if they're in their 30s now. So that was my first like, oh, what's he doing? It kind of sounds like hip hop, but it kind of sounds like jazz, and it's poetry. And I write poems, you know, I've been writing poems since I was 12. But seeing that movie was the first time I tried to write more of almost a full length sort of spoken word monologue type thing. So I remember writing that when I was probably a junior in high school. And, you know, now San Antonio has a spoken word scene. There's slam poetry there and all these places where you can go. But it wasn't like that, you know, 20 some years ago. So I was just kind of in my notebook and, you know, writing raps with my friends and doing that. You know, I really got more and more into spoken word itself as a culture and as an art form when I moved to Atlanta, which is where I live now. And there's such a thriving scene here even now, but definitely was then. And so that's really where I cut my chops, you know, performing and being around poets who were so much better than me.
Was poetry or even literature, was that something that your parents or family were into at home?
Yeah, my mom is a big reader. I grew up in a home full of books. James Baldwin and Nikki Giovanni and Maya Angelou, all these books all the time. So I think that was a part of what made me want to write, because I loved what books do as a reader. You know, I loved what books do. So I was like, oh, I want to do this. Whatever you do to get these words in a book, I want to do that. But I still think I was thinking more like becoming a novelist or something. I really thought I was going to be a novelist until I was probably 22 or 23 years old, and probably realized at that point that I was actually a bad fiction writer and that probably wasn't going to work out too well. For me. But it took me a long time to even consider that spoken word could be a career. The fact that it became a career was totally a surprise to me.
Well, and I think part of that is legitimate because, like you said, there wasn't a scene around it then. So there really weren't, the idea of being like a professional spoken word poet, that's kind of a modern invention.
Yeah, I think so. At the time that I was really starting to perform spoken word, this is probably 98, 99, the only two poets I knew who were full-time was Jessica Care Moore and Saul Williams. And they were just like, you know, they were the idols of everyone who loved spoken word poetry, but almost in a way that no one was really trying to do what they were doing, because it just seemed like, well, that's impossible. You know, like you support them in being that. But it just seemed like, well, maybe there's only two slots for people to be full-time doing this. And those two people have it. And the rest of us are just going to go to open mics and enjoy our part we have. You know, I totally didn't even think what is happening now, where so many poets are able to sustain themselves full-time without starving for the most part. I totally didn't think that was going to be a thing.
Did you have a moment where you realized that you were a spoken word poet, as in like vocationally?
I have only been a spoken word poet full time vocationally for almost 8 years. It'll be 8 years January for me. It'll be 10 years if you include the really, really, really broke years, because there were some really broke years on the front end of that. So I think I kind of felt like I was making a lateral move. I was coming out of corporate America. I had been working as a writer for a Fortune 500 company here in Atlanta, and I hated my job. I just hated my job so bad. And I wanted to be doing what I felt called to do, what I loved. And so I just got my Christmas bonus 1 year and totally quit that job and pretty quickly went broke after that. So I had to learn some things about what that actually was going to look like. I think sometimes there's this glamorous view that we have of being a full-time artist, you know, that's like, I sit around in my PJs all day and someone pays me millions of dollars to be brilliant. You know, like you're not thinking it's going to involve you having to do all this hard work, involve you writing when you don't feel inspired. And in a lot of ways, I was an English major in college. So we did a lot of study of Langston Hughes, you know, and one of the things I remember one of my favorite professors, Dr. Harper, who is a Langston Hughes scholar, she would always tell us, look at all these things Langston Hughes did to be a full-time writer. You know, he was a poet and a playwright, and he wrote short stories, and, you know, he was doing all these things, sort of what we would call the hustle now. So I really looked at it like, okay, well, I'm doing spoken word and I'm doing some workshops, and, you know, you're just kind of taking all your talents you think you have and seeing how they'll flesh out in a job. So that took me a while to learn and to realize to become a full-time artist is to become an entrepreneur. It is not that you will be a full-time artist and someone else will do the business for you, that you have to also have the mind of a business person too. So I had to learn that. That was basically what was the school of hard knocks in the broke years. That was my major, was entrepreneurship, when I attended the school of going broke for 2 years.
That has been something that to me has been really fascinating to learn as I've hosted the show and I talk to people like yourself and musicians, is that the thing that makes them a good artist and the thing that makes them succeed as an artist, as in getting a paycheck for it, are two different skills. And even sometimes they're at odds with each other. The thing that makes them a good artist does not make them a good business person. Mm-hmm. It sounds like what you're saying is that was a lesson you had to learn along the way.
Yeah. And I think I'm in an interesting place sometimes because I am a performing artist and I'm also a speaker. So I don't have that many friends who are doing both of those. I have a lot of friends who are speakers, and then I have a lot of friends who are artists. There's only like a certain number of us that do both of those things. And so I think in the world of speaking, there is more of this idea of business under there, because you sort of have clients and you are being hired to maybe do these workshops or this keynote for this event. And I think for a lot of artists, and maybe, I don't know if some of this is generational, like I, you know, was going to high school in the 90s, and that was this time where a lot of artists were making it big with these big record labels, these big entities behind them. And by the time a lot of us became adults, there wasn't going to be a big entity to invest in you or to A&R you in the ways that we watched a lot of artists during that time be A&R'd. You know, there wasn't going to be a Clive Davis to make you Alicia Keys or to make you Whitney Houston. You know, you were really going to have to figure out who you were yourself and tell your own story and use the resources that you have. So I think a lot of us, or a lot of people I know that sort of entered this world around the same time I did, you entered entrepreneurship sort of from the back door of it, realizing, oh yeah, I'm an entrepreneur now. I didn't think that's what I would be, but okay, you know.
Well, and now I guess the good thing about that is someone with talent can, say, start a YouTube channel or some other venue like that instead of having to be discovered somehow by someone who has the power. It's a little bit more democratized these days.
Yeah, I think that's totally a plus. And I think, too, you know, we watched that sort of A&Ring work out well for some artists, and we've also watched it work out terribly wrong, where in that attempt to A&R you, brand you, make you into this star, it was silencing your voice and who you really wanted to be. I think Pink as an artist is always such a great inspiration to me in that, you know, I feel like when she entered the space of the music industry, there was this attempt to like make Pink into something. And she fought very hard in her career to really be herself. And that's totally paid off. I watched one of her recent performances on SNL and I was just like, Pink, I am so glad that you're you, that you didn't continue trying to be that thing they wanted to make you be. So I do think now that the playing field has been leveled in so many ways with things like YouTube and social media and just the access that we have now to be able to find out about artists and music and storytellers and things like that, I think there is a lot of beauty to that for the listener or the consumer, and also for the artist, that you have a place where you can set up your own stage anytime that you want. Obviously, that can have its downsides too, bless. But on the positive side, you have a place where you can tell your story, where you can be heard, and where there can be an audience of people, and you're not waiting for this middle person to come in and go, I'll be the one to get you on the such and such stage, you know?
You mentioned doing spoken word and speaking for a living. And I wonder if you think a lot about the relationship between those two, the differences, and then maybe the things that being good at one would make you better at the other.
I really have to say, Shane, for the most part, even when I am brought in to speak, for the most part, I'm still performing some poems somewhere in there. So sure. it's very rare that I would do a complete talk without sharing poetry of some kind. I feel like where I've landed on that, and this also took me some time, but I've landed on, I like to be in the sweet spot of a combination of poetry and storytelling. And I think that's where I'm strong. I don't necessarily know if that makes me like a motivational speaker or, you know, whatever those, wherever those labels go. But I know those are two things that I can do and that I can do well in connection with the audience, is I can perform poetry and I can tell a good story. And so I try, even when I'm speaking, to lead into that. Someone did ask me recently about how what you learn as a spoken word poet, how that translates into speaking. And I do think spoken word, and for me, because I did slam poetry for a little while, spoken word to me is still within that 3-minute sort of time frame of a slam poem.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Like when you're competing in a slam competition as a spoken word poet, you have 3 minutes and 10 seconds. You have a 10 second grace period to basically get your point across or tell your story or whatever it is. So you really have to have some economy with how you want to communicate. Obviously now I don't do slam poetry, so I could go on stage and do a 4.5 minute poem. I wouldn't advise it, but I could do it. But my mind almost got into the routine of staying within that 3 minutes. Sometimes maybe I'll go into the 3 minutes, 30 seconds. And I think the idea that you can communicate a point, that you can emotionally affect an audience, that you can make them think about something and think about why they're doing what they're doing, or think about the words they say or the way they live, that you can try your best to do that in 3 minutes. I think that is a skill that bodes well in a speaking environment, because I do find most times there's this like very strange internal clock that I have going when I'm talking on stage. And so sometimes I've gotten up there and I had 45 minutes of stuff prepared and I'm like, oh man, that went by in 25 minutes. I walked off stage. You know, I said everything I was supposed to say, but I had the clock going like, oh no, I had to do like a 7-minute talk once and I was super nervous. And I think I walked off stage at like 6:59, you know? So I do think spoken word sort of pushes me to think about the ways I can really say what it is I need to say and say it in a way that opens strong, that closes strong, that hopefully has some emotional impact on the audience, whether it makes them laugh or cry or be quiet while they're thinking about whatever it is. And that totally impacts the ways that I approach that longer stage time too.
I mean, when I think of really good preachers, they have this ability to say something and use the words in such a way where I think I've heard other preachers try to say that thing before, and they got the facts out there. But for whatever reason, when this really good preacher said it, they used the words in such a way that it, you know, made it stick to my ribs. And I think there's got to be a relationship between that and, you know, the idea of poetry, of selecting these words and communicating something really deep in a short period of time.
I was thinking about the title of your podcast, and I was like, oh, I'm not really a seminary dropout. And then I was like, I actually might be a little bit, because ironically, I thought that I was going to become a preacher when I was junior high, high school age. I grew up in a church where I watched a lot of women preach all the time. And it just, I just felt inside like something about me and them was the same. So it was my intention initially to go into college and go to seminary right after. And I grew up in a church setting that was definitely more traditional in a lot of ways, you know, elder, deacon, missionary, evangelist, prophet, pastor, you know, there were the titles, you know, it's very rare anyone was, you know, called by their first name. And so I think maybe the preacher part is still there with me in some ways. It just came out in me very differently. I actually come from a long line of preachers on both sides of my family. And this is just how it showed up in me. So some people say, well, that, you know, that's still preaching. I'm like, well, maybe it is. You know, I just ended up going this totally different way. I went into college ministry and obviously went into spoken word and some of that stuff and never quite even made it to seminary like I thought I would. But I totally think I'm doing what I was supposed to be doing in the end.
I mean, that's what I was going to say. Some might say you did become a preacher, Amina.
Yeah, I'm with it.
You're very transparent in the book about a lot of things, but early in the book, you talk about having a disconnect between the idea of a princess and how a lot of girls will immediately latch on to those images and feel like they fit into that narrative. But that was something that was always kind of a disconnect for you.
Yeah. And I would always feel really weird that I felt disconnected from it. Like as a little girl, I felt very disconnected from that. And as I got older, you know, sort of coming into womanhood, I just still felt like, yeah, that just doesn't really seem like me. You know, I didn't feel like the damsel in distress type, you know? So I just always kind of eschewed any of that princess motif. And, I remember talking to, well, my now husband, he was my fiance then. And I think it was actually talking with him about that word. I think he asked me, did you ever see yourself like that? And I was like, no, never saw myself that way. So the book really, writing that chapter was really the first time I was exploring, why was I always like that? You know, I don't remember reading a lot of fairy tales or anything like that. I don't remember reading those things or being fascinated by them at all, or any of the cartoons or anything, you know. So that setting of the story itself in the book, where I'm there in front of this room of girls and they're like, who's your favorite princess? And I didn't have one. Like the gasp in the room was like, okay. Oh dear, what will I do to turn this around? You know, like, oh no, you know. So I think exploring that idea even of what actually happens to the princess in most of the fairy tales that we know that have become that narrative for a lot of people. And when I explored that idea that a lot of sort of the princess in the fairy tale actually comes from some place where she was abandoned or she was rejected, that the princess very rarely in a fairy tale comes from this like two-parent home where there were all the resources and she had everything that she needed at her feet. Most of the princesses that we see in a lot of our famous, you know, Snow White, Cinderella, whatever those sort of types of fairy tales are, those characters came from a lot of brokenness. And that was kind of interesting because then I was like, oh, maybe I'm more princess than I thought, you know, all those things, you know, sort of grappling with that, like, oh, well, all right, princess. That was kind of my first time, like, okay, girl, all right, you know. But I did like the idea, though, that there is this princess idea is being rewritten in a lot of ways now for younger girls and being unwritten in a lot of ways, to say, like, that doesn't have to be the ideal, that you are there waiting for someone to rescue you, waiting for someone to come to the top of the tower. Like, you can have your boots on the ground too. So I do like the way there is this generation of young women that are not feeling stunted by that narrative. And I find a lot of power and beauty in that. I think that's overturning some things in a wonderful way.
You mentioned how being raised by your mother and your grandmother, far from having that image of the damsel in distress being fostered, it was, you were taught to be, you know, strong and independent. And that too, the stereotype of a strong Black woman has become something that I know a lot of Black women feel burdened by. And I wonder if feeling like your choices were damsel in distress, princess, and being a strong Black woman was something that you had to pick one or the other.
I think I did feel that tension for a while of, okay, well, I definitely don't feel like the damsel in distress, but I probably lean or was leaning more towards feeling like, well, I have to be some kind of super shero almost, who does not hurt and does not stop to have to, you know, contemplate this pain or these things. You know, she is so strong. She keeps going. She keeps moving. And one book that really helped me a lot to process that was Dr. Shaniqua Walker Barnes' book, Too Heavy a Yoke, where she talks a lot about the myth of the strong Black woman. And not to say that you cannot be a Black woman and be strong. You can, but it's the myth. Just the same as the myth of the princess can become our undoing in a lot of ways. And so a lot of the work I was trying to do in my life and also work out in that chapter of the book was, I can just be a woman and be a Black woman and be a human being. And sometimes that's strong and sometimes it's weak, and sometimes things hold together and sometimes they just don't. And being able to be okay with that fluidity. So I think in a way it is to undo a lot of the wrong of those narratives that says, well, if I'm princess, I have to have it together all the time. I have to look like this all the time. I have to appear to be, you know, this sort of put together, demure woman, or I have to always be ready to fight and be strong and not need anything or anyone. And that really healthy for me is to be in the middle of that, to be in the tensions of that in some ways, of like, man, some days I am going to fight until my heart's content. I'm going to fight. And some days I'm just going to cry my eyes out. And that doesn't make it wrong or make me weak in a bad way. That weak is not good or bad. It just is human. So I do think I have walked through, and I'm still walking through in a lot of ways, a healing journey on that. I talk to a lot of women, particularly women who are leading, that are walking through the healing of those narratives and really taking that power back and recreating a better narrative for yourself, a truer and more balanced and more gracious narrative.
The word I keep coming back to is what you said was human. That no human is all of one of those things. We're complex and we have conflicting feelings, and some days we're strong and some days we feel weak. And that's what it means to be human, as God made us to be.
Yeah.
Your upbringing in mind, one, I think we're, if not the same age, really close to the same age. Also, our church upbringing was super similar. You didn't get married till you were in your 30s, right?
Yeah.
So I got married when I was just a few days before like my 25th birthday. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, and I went to a Christian college, small Christian university. And I remember thinking, feeling like I had held out pretty long before getting married, which seems really silly now that that was like 10 years ago. But so many people that I knew in college had gotten married before me, gotten married in college or just right out of college. And I wonder if why you feel like you didn't have that pressure, or you didn't really even think about dating till you were like 25, it sounds like, from the book. Why were you, why do you think that you had that draw to other things and that not that interest earlier on, like so many people do?
Man, I'm like, well, there's so many layers to that. I think a part of it, I guess I'm like, here's the onion, right? I'm like, okay, layer one of that was growing up in a house full of women where there was not the pressure to like hurry up and get a man. If anything, I was getting the opposite advice, like, you need to do well in high school. You need to go to college and do well there. You might need to get your master's degree. Like, you have things you need to do, love and marriage and all those things that will come later, but you don't want to enter the world as a woman and not have a way that you can take care of yourself. That is not, you want to have some way you can take care of yourself that's not dependent upon a man, is sort of implicitly and explicitly the way that I was raised. So I didn't have that family pressure of like, get married. It was definitely more of the pressure to get educated and put your, you know, passion and your energy, you know, into doing that. So that was layer one. I think layer two on top of that, because the women who were a part of raising me, that was two generations of single mothers, I saw how hard that was for them. And so I did have avoidance for a long time of just like, okay, whatever one has to do to have a baby, which seems like is sex, let's not do that. And let's not date. And let's just avoid all men except for in work environments. Let's just not have any personal interactions, because doesn't seem like statistically that's going to turn out well, you know, as far as what I knew growing up. So I think that was a part of it. You know, I think my church upbringing definitely like played a role in that, that I grew up in a church where women were very empowered. So it wasn't that our church upbringing was discouraging us from marriage. We were totally encouraged to get married, but we weren't encouraged that marriage would make us something, or that marriage was this thing you should put your identity into, or that you have not made it until you marry. I knew a lot of single women in my church that never married. Of course, I didn't know them personally to know how they felt about that. They may have hated that. They may have loved it, you know, but there was not a negative attachment to their singleness in our church community. So I think all that really influenced like the layers of how that happened for me. And then I did get to about 27 when I was like, okay, God, like, I feel like what I got going on is like really great. Shouldn't somebody come here and be a part of it? Shouldn't somebody be here, you know, to participate in this? This is a good time for it. But it obviously was not the time according to God. It was a great time to me, but not to God, you know. And of course I look back on that now and I'm like, oh, that seemed like a perfect time to get married to me. But 31 was the right time, because the man that I married was totally the right person for me to walk through this life with. So there's all those things about the will of God and the sovereignty of God that I don't get and don't understand, but I definitely have had moments in my life like meeting my husband and thinking, yeah, that what felt like delay was actually right on time. Totally.
Those circumstances that you described with your mother and your church upbringing, that is really rare, especially for a church to have what I think is a really healthy view of marriage, because way too many churches are too encouraging about marriage. I don't know if that's the word for it, but they do. The thing you said was they didn't wrap their identity in it. And I think so many churches do that, especially for women. They act as if the goal is to just find a nice Christian guy who can take care of you. It's very rare for churches to really hold that in the right place where it should be held.
I just remember growing up in church and hearing our pastors preach about how you can even be lonely inside of a marriage. I remember hearing that as a teenager.
That's crazy. I mean, none of our pastors ever told us that. And that's exactly what they should have been telling us, but they never
told
us that. You won the church lottery, I think.
I really did in so many ways. You know, I didn't know it at the time. You know, you're there in youth group or whatever, and you're just like, oh man, here comes the Kirk Franklin song, you know? And then you become an adult and you're like, wow, that place really like shaped me in a lot of ways. But I think even some of those real statements that they weren't saying from stage for me to hear, you know, they were saying that in a way to help pastor some of the other couples and other adults, you know, who were there. It wasn't a comment meant for me necessarily, but I remember hearing that and thinking, well, that's interesting. Like, I would think you get married so you don't ever have to be lonely. So then it made me go, okay, well, if you can get married and still be lonely, then the reasons why you marry have to be better than that. You know, they have to be more than that. Just like, I don't want to go to Chili's by myself. Like, I remember thinking that once I turned 30, I was like, you know what? I'm at a point in my life, like I can travel by myself. I can go to Chili's by myself. I can buy a house by myself if I want to. Like, so I don't want a man in my life just to do those things with, you know, we got to have something else better going on than that. But now that I think about it, I'm like, I probably obviously was very highly influenced by some of the ways that our pastors were trying to pastor us in the ways of how marriage really is. Maybe that's what we needed more of in church, you know?
So you met Matt. What was it about him? How did you guys meet? I can't remember that part.
We met at church, even though I swore up and down I would not date a man I met at church. That was not going well for me at the time. All the church guys that I was meeting, they were either very intimidated in what I thought was a strange way, because I'm like, I'm standing here talking to you with a pair of sneakers on. Like, what? Why are you feeling intimidated by this? Or they were very timid about just saying, well, I think you're gorgeous. I would like to go to coffee with you. So there was all this in between, like, well, I'd like to go to Starbucks, but like, not like we're brother and sister in Christ, but not like we're going on a date. So like, we should go there and talk, but you should pay for yours and I pay for mine. You know, like, it was all this weird, like, you think I'm fly, just come out and say you do and ask me to dinner, you know, stop it. This is getting to be so stupid. But then I'd go out to these other things and meet men who did not consider themselves Christians at all, would walk right up and say, hi, I think you're so beautiful. You know, tell me your name. I'd love to know more about you, but would love to go to dinner with you or have drinks with you sometime, you know? And you're like, well, here I am out here. I really would like to be with the man who shares my faith values here, but you guys are, I don't know what you're doing. And I'm out here with people who don't maybe share my same faith values, but are able to communicate. Like, I don't understand. So that's sort of the frustrating place I was in when he and I met at the church. And I swore up and down I would not date a man I met at church. But we were actually friends for 2 years. We met at that church and stayed in touch. He was also a performing artist too. So we did shows together. And I think maybe that time of us being friends really helped break some of the barriers down, because we were just, you know, in our sweatpants, going to different shows, you know, like in the studio and things like that, really took all the pretentiousness away from it. So I'm thankful for that now. At the time, I was like, this whole thing is very weird, all this dating.
What did you like about Matt when you first started to get to know him better?
Man, I liked that. Well, first of all, I mean, it took me like a second meeting. The first meeting, I didn't notice how attractive he was for some reason. But the second meeting, I was like, oh, okay, come on, Kangol. Come on. This is very attractive. So I was very on board with that. And I think he thought very similarly to me about art and faith and some of the beautiful ways art and faith intersect and some of the terrible things that we've done to art in the name of faith. And I remember thinking that that was so brilliant, you know, like listening to him and listening to his perspective on that. And I just thought he was a wonderful friend. I think it sort of snuck up on both of us that we were like trying to spend more time with each other all the time. And sort of in that dance of like, is this going to ruin the friendship? Is this going to make the friendship even more awesome? So in our case, it totally made the friendship more awesome that we started dating after 2 years of, I don't know, my sister was like, you guys spent 2 years basically dating each other. You just told us you were friends. I was like, no, we were friends. We really were.
Y'all knew you wanted to get married pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that's like a product of being in your 30s or what, but I was definitely like at a point in my life where I really wasn't just wanting to date because it's super fun, because some of it's not really fun. It was fun for a while, but then you get to a point where you're like, okay, I'm tired of figuring out who likes mac and cheese and who doesn't, who's from Ohio and not. It's just too much to keep track of now. So once we started dating, we were pretty sure early on that we were interested in more commitment out of the relationship, went into meeting each other's families and all of that. So I think in part too, I was more sure in my own skin. I knew what it was I felt God was calling me to do, the type of person that I felt I would need to walk through this life with me. And I think he was in that similar place. So we didn't really need a lot more time. We were sure we wanted to build a life together. So we knew we were going to start out kind of broke, but we could be together through that. We could build and make it through that together, you know?
If money is their biggest problem in that scenario, then there are a lot worse problems to have.
Right, right.
Matt was a youth minister at a small church. I think I mentioned that. And you had were coming off of like a bad church experience.
Yeah.
Where you had been wounded by a church. And it sounds like that small church really kind of brought some healing for you.
Yeah, I remember Matt and I being in premarital counseling. And there were a few points in the counseling where the pastor who was also going to marry us was like, okay, when we get to this part, your homework is you and Matt, you have to come to an agreement about this. And church was one of those. And at the time, I was very much like not a Sunday person. Like I was going to my small group, but if people were looking for me on Sunday, like they were never going to see me there. Because in my work life, I was basically going to church services all the time. Like I was at plenty of services. I was hearing plenty of sermons. The part I wasn't getting was where someone sits across from you with this Bible open to talk with you about how is your life lining up with what this says? How are you wrestling with what's here? Those things. So when I realized, oh man, I'm about to marry a youth pastor, I remember we were sitting at a burger place arguing over Sunday because Matt's like, I would like for you to, you know, be in church with me and, you know, we can sit and, you know, we listen to the sermon together. We can talk about, you know, what the sermon says, how we filter that into our lives and stuff, you know. And I remember being like, well, some Sundays we need to go to the park because Jesus is at the park too. I remember us arguing about that. At a burger place, you know, and I mean, still correct. Jesus is at the park too. And some Sundays now that he's no longer on church staff, we do go to the park on Sundays, you know, but a part of what I had to do in my healing process was realize like my husband is just asking to be in community with me. And what's bad about that? You know, like I can sit in church with my husband and listen to the sermon and talk to him about it. And he also learned like, hey, there are going to be some weekends she's worked and, you know, been speaking at all these events. Like she needs that Sunday sometimes to not be at church. But because we were in a smaller church, we mattered so much to them. They wanted to know how we were doing. They wanted to be praying for us. It was very, very grounding to be there while he was on staff there. And so I think there was a lot of just healing and triggering too. I think church can be very triggering, especially when you've had a bad church experience, and learning, how do I heal from that? Where are those wounds I have with God? Where are the wounds I have with church, and how all of this works, and the parts of that I believe and the parts of that I don't anymore? And letting myself walk through that healing. And that church was actually a really great place to do that.
There's something about smaller churches, and I'm not an anti-big church guy, but just the simplicity of it. It's like, I get that big churches have practical concerns to deal with, and that they, you know, they need 12 committees for various things, and they need people out directing traffic in their parking lot. But there's something so beautiful about the simplicity of a small church, when you can focus all your energies on the Jesus part. Mm-hmm. There's something about that that's so healing, and also it kind of puts our cynicism about church at bay.
Yeah, I really think there's something to the small space in general. Even when I was a part of a larger, you know, what would be considered probably a mega church, where I learned the most about Jesus, where I grew the most in my relationship with Jesus, was still in that small space where it was me and seven other women, you know, arguing over A.W. Tozer and having to open up this Bible and talk about our lives. I think there is, wherever we are, there is something to be said for having a smaller, simpler space where people know us, and where we're not sort of swallowed up in our anonymity. I definitely have been through times spiritually where I needed to go to that church where I could be anonymous, where nobody's wondering where I am, you know, where I needed to heal that way. And so I get that. But I think there's something really healing to the small space there of people looking you in your eyes, having to walk through your painful stuff with you. I think that is what that is church to me. Like, when I say church, that's what I am in need of. That's what I want to be a part of with other people, making the meals when people are sick, when they have their babies. Like, that's the stuff that's church, not just what we deem to be the lights or the smoke or the words to the song on the screen. Those things can be church too. But for me, I definitely find church more so in this small space.
Well, I mean, I had such a good time reading about your life and How to Fix a Broken Record. And I'm so glad I got to sit down and talk with you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Shane. I feel like I can now say I'm officially a seminary dropout now. So that's good.
Yeah, I'll send you the honorary non-degree in the mail. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SEMINARYDROPOUT, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right. Thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But